This is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Wolf declares a state of emergency to deal with the opioid crisis. How will this help people battling the epidemic? And gadgets and gizmos galore. Pittsburgh companies show off their innovations at the world's largest consumer tech event. That's coming up later. But first, the results from Give Big Pittsburgh were down sharply from its earlier incarnation. Are people financially fatigued late in the year? How important are these foundation-inspired initiatives to nonprofits in the Pittsburgh area, their services, and, of course, their clients? What is the overall health of small nonprofits, and will they be hurt by the new tax reform law? We're going to discuss all of that and more with Joyce Gannon, reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Natasha Lindstrom, reporter with the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
As always, your participation is encouraged. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. The contributions pulled in from Give Big Pittsburgh, Giving Tuesday was the date it was done, were down 33% from its precursor in 2016. Of course, this followed Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday. So was it a matter of people didn't have much left? Their wallets were empty. Their credit cards were bent. Are they financially fatigued? We'll start with you, Joyce.
Well, Kevin, I don't think that's really what's going on locally. Because if you look at Giving Tuesday, which has become a worldwide event, contributions were $274 million. And that's huge. And it's a huge increase from the prior year, 2016, when they totaled $168 million. So, and the average gift, by the way, was $111 per donor. So that's significant. Mm-hmm. And I think locally, the Give Big initiative was down from the prior event because it's a different event and it has a different sponsor. And it was, I think, promoted differently prior to Give Big Pittsburgh. There was a day of giving that had gone on since 2009, which was launched by the Pittsburgh Foundation.
Right.
And they have been over the last few years, the foundation has been trying to shift away from a day of giving and do some different kinds of online giving initiatives.
All right. We want to talk a little bit about Natasha. I want to get your take on that, whether it was the change in sponsorship or some other reasons why that Tuesday in Pittsburgh, Give Big Pittsburgh, did less than its predecessor did.
Well, I think it's hard to say. There's a lot of factors, as I mentioned, but I think that there still was a sizable amount of money raised. I know there was some concern among a variety of local nonprofits, though, including the likes of the Salvation Army of Western Pennsylvania, who did suggest that perhaps because we faced so many natural disasters in the summer and natural and non-natural, you know, a lot of devastation and people feel like maybe they were tapped out. There was that fear. But I think we have seen a lot of giving both in 2016 and 2017 continuing. It should be noted, too, there was actually a huge bump in giving that the Pittsburgh Foundation saw right after the Trump election, for instance, when there was a lot of uncertainty as well about what tax policy changes would bring. But some of it is a little tricky because we're probably still getting some of the year-end numbers, really, as we start the 2018 year.
Right.
And we'll have to kind of evaluate where people are actually putting their
I'm sorry. So it wasn't necessarily those 3, 4, 5 days that were sort of compacted where dollars are going out of people's wallets, per se. It was more of a cumulative thing during the course of the year.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep that in mind. And you know, like you said, with a change of a sponsor, different events, or how it's promoted, I think individually, some individual nonprofits actually saw really good, you have to look at the ones who are taking the most advantage of putting themselves out there and advertising their events. A lot of people organize really interesting Giving Tuesday things to really generate support and put out email newsletters and alerts and do in-person events. And so the ones that probably were more active on that front, as opposed to just hoping the money rolled in, were probably saw better results.
Joyce, can you give us a brief explanation of that transition? You both have talked about a different sponsor. What was the purpose behind that
Well, as I said before, the Pittsburgh Foundation had launched Giving Tuesday, or not Giving Tuesday, they launched their own day of giving back in 2009.
Right.
And in recent years, they said, you know, they said to me and probably to Natasha too that they wanted to shift away from that because it had been a drain on their own resources, having staff available to run it, raising prize money, and doing the match. And,
right.
And the match was a very big incentive for local nonprofits to participate because the foundation kicked in several $100,000 and would match every gift that came in.
So, I mean, that's a big incentive. I know I'm in public radio, and I know when we have matching dollars during fundraisers, they are quite helpful. So the lack of match, you think it did impact?
Oh, absolutely, because when they shifted away from it in 2016, I talked to a couple nonprofits who said, we're not going to do a big push on the day of giving with the foundation because there's no more match money. And to us, we can do our own fundraising, our own events, and bring in what we would get out of that.
Do we know if any individual nonprofits in the area are having any luck with sort of inspiring, digging up their own matches? Do we know of anything like that they're going after their own matches?
I think certainly so. And I would say that technology and how there's so many fundraising platforms that are accessible out there now to nonprofits have maybe democratized the playing field in that way where they can get the word out. It should be noted that a website like GoFundMe, which isn't even a nonprofit, so to speak, generates more charitable dollars than like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I think, right. Annually nowadays. So, you know, nonprofits can take advantage of things like that, and maybe individuals can too who want to just generate money, whether it's through Facebook or a GoFundMe account or the like.
Let's talk a little bit about technology. Give us an assessment of, I assume it's across the board, but how nonprofits are using technology to their benefit in terms of their financial well-being and raising the dollars they need for services.
Joan? Well, I think they've all jumped in and they're doing Twitter and doing email to alert everybody about whatever kind of fundraising they're doing. And before Giving Tuesday, I just receive an onslaught both in my own work email and via Twitter and also in my own personal home email because of charities that I donate to.
Right.
And, you know, that's how people are giving. Online giving is very, very big. Now, that's not to say that people don't sit down at the end of the year and write out their checks to their standard charities, but nonprofits they've really jumped in on this, I think.
What sort of message are you getting? How are they talking to you? Is the message different online than it is receiving in snail mail, that letter saying, won't you please help us out, et cetera?
Well, I think it's a lot more concise, right. Because that's what social media is. You know, they try to get right to the heart of it.
That being said, they can also use it to their advantage to show the stories, to use multimedia to kind of maybe get at people's, you know, hearts in a different way, or, you know, to kind of, there's definitely also more of a focus on trying to show us the results you're getting. If they have data to show through an infographic, through an email, you know, that maybe that's more compelling than just making a phone call, or there are a lot of, you know, things that.
Well, I want to bring up one more question about technology, definitely, and that was, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's only been a handful, maybe several years, that the Salvation Army actually started accepting online donations. They relied for years and years and decades on their physical red kettles. I believe that's only been a handful of years.
It's true, and they've actually, I haven't been able to get the latest results on the percentage they're bringing in from the online red kettles, which they do now at onlineredkettle.org, but it seems like that it hasn't quite caught on like they'd like. They're trying to promote it more. I know they've been doing a lot more advertising to get the word out there because fewer people are carrying around change and cash in their pockets to drop into that red bucket when they leave the store, even if they want to. I could see more, you know, things like apps that make it easy to donate on the fly. Things like that might be useful down the road too, but just more about trying to figure out how to reach people where they are these days and where they have money to spend.
Right, reaching people, but are the Pittsburgh area nonprofits, and I'm asking you to generalize, but are they sort of hip with helping people to pay conveniently, different ways of paying, different ways of contributing?
I think they are. I think they're all realizing that if they want to reach new and younger donors, that's what you have to do. It's just like, you know, how business and everybody else is working now. Having an online presence, having a social media presence is really, really important. Now, one issue that comes up with online giving is the fee aspect. And that's another reason that nonprofits and donors get a little edgy about some things that go on online, because you have to do a credit card fee. And then it's, you know, where's that money going to go? And instead of doing just writing a check in the traditional manner.
Go ahead,
I think another important trend in giving to note, especially when it comes to the foundation level, and some commercial competitors, are the rise in what are called donor advised funds. The Pittsburgh Foundation has seen at least 3 consecutive years of growth in donor advised funds. And these are attractive to donors because they provide the benefits of greater tax deductions, more flexibility over spending, and fewer regulatory costs and hassles than they would if they formed their own private foundation, while still having control over where they want the grant money to go. But they doesn't have all of the paperwork and the tax forms, et cetera, you need to file when you do a private foundation. Now, these have been criticized on one respect by critics who worry these are sort of being used as tax shelters, or people can kind of hoard their charitable money for years because there's no set payout requirement. But the Pittsburgh Foundation says that they actually see these as a really valuable tool. They've noticed more and more donors want to give while they're alive, as opposed to just bequeath things after their death. They want to have an active role in the decision-making of where the money's going. And so for some families, that's been an ideal choice. So maybe you don't see them making those cash donations because they're turning to another vehicle, such as a donor advised fund.
Well, that gets me into tax reform. How will those methods through funds or individual donations be affected by the new tax reform law? And then we'll just go to, you know, people just doing their normal contributions to charities. Do we know how those particular methods might be affected by the tax reform law?
Well, I can tell you that a lot of the charitable sector, especially some of our top leaders here in Western PA, are very concerned. They put out some pretty scathing statements saying that they think the plan puts the charitable sector directly in harm's way, primarily because it takes away the incentive to give for a majority of Americans. Majority of Americans will not have the incentive to itemize. And so unless they have more than $24,000 for a married couple and deductions to claim, you're not going to get any break at all for filing or for giving to charity.
Yeah, and that incentive, as Natasha just said, is what drives people to give, particularly at the end of the year.
Right.
And, you know, you can sit down and do a gift to numerous charities. It doesn't have to be that big of a gift. And you'll still be able to deduct a portion of it on your tax return. This is now. But
right.
With the tax reform, as she said, there's going to be, you know, the deduction is going to go up for everybody so that, well, you know, you can ignore maybe your charitable donations because you're still going to have a deduction to take. An individual or family deduction without making any donations. So, yeah, nonprofits are scared.
Yeah. To be clear, the new tax reform law does not eliminate charitable deductions.
No.
But the concern is over, because some deductions are eliminated, it would
cut into,
discourage people from itemizing, and so therefore the ripple effect of making charitable contributions.
Right, right. And as I said, nonprofits really rely on that feeling that, oh, people are going to say, you know, I can deduct this. Now, people still will give because they believe in the mission, they believe in a nonprofit, they believe in public radio, whatever it might be.
Right.
But without that incentive, you know, it comes down to dollars and cents.
Right. We were talking a little bit about the foundations transitioning away from Day of Giving, et cetera, those big events. Last week, the Pittsburgh Foundation announced recipients of its Small and Mighty Grants program, nearly $309,000 to 22 organizations. Michelle McMurray, Senior Program Officer for Health and Human Services at Pittsburgh Foundation, told the Confluence producer, Megan Harris, that the recipients are smaller, less visible organizations.
Smaller organizations have to plan very meticulously for the kinds of programs and services they can offer. And so knowing, I think, early on in the year what resources you will have access to helps them to do a lot better planning and forward thinking about how they're going to operate throughout the calendar year.
So how important are these individualized programs, these for specific grants, how important are they in general to the nonprofits, in particular the smaller nonprofits in the Pittsburgh area?
Joyce? Well, Small and Mighty, which was launched a year ago, really is targeted to very, very small nonprofits that wouldn't be on the radar of a big foundation otherwise. And that's the aim there, is to say, okay, here's somebody that maybe only has a one-person foundation that, you know, they do the work and they have volunteers helping them, whether it's, you know, some kind of work in the schools or whatever it might be. And this is a way for them to get several thousand dollars, which to a big nonprofit wouldn't mean that much. To a small organization, it's a lot of money.
I would say for a lot of smaller organizations, it also gives them sort of this stamp of approval in the same realm as funding that comes from a state entity or the likes of the regional Allegheny Regional Asset District, which funds small arts groups. Every group that gets funded by these foundations is vetted, and so by getting that grant and getting that approval, it can be a ripple effect for them. It can snowball into more money from more sources.
So whether it is the impact of the new tax reform law, or whether it's a decline in giving, or even a spread out to other factors, whether they're natural disasters, whatever, do we have a sense, have you sort of explored how this might affect especially the nonprofits that don't really have that big megaphone, that, you know, it's not as easy for them to raise dollars? They might be more, reliant on foundations or others. Are we concerned about impact on services for some of these organizations?
Yes, indeed. And Natasha mentioned earlier that last week or shortly after the tax reform bill came out, United Way, the Pittsburgh Foundation, came out with a very, very strong statement, worried about human services and this idea that maybe people aren't going to be as motivated to give. And, you know, if they can't see that on their tax return, you know, what's going to happen to a homeless shelter or a food pantry? Those are critical needs. And I might add that the Pittsburgh Foundation, indeed, as they have moved away from Day of Giving, they now are doing sporadic critical needs alerts where they say, we're going to raise money, we're going to do an online appeal, and they've been able to target things like hunger, homelessness.
Right. And a lot of these organizations, I assume, don't even have their own safety net, if you would, for their clients who need a safety net.
Right. And then to put some numbers on, too, this tax bill impact, yesterday, an estimate came out from the Tax Policy Center stating that they think that the number of households who will claim an itemized deduction will drop from 37 million down to only 16 million this year, and that charitable giving could drop from about $63 billion to $42 billion for the federal income tax subsidy for giving. And so and locally, in that statement they put out, I'd say that could mean the likes of, for Allegheny County, tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars when it comes to across the region. So when you are this small nonprofit who's relying on a few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars, and we're losing a substantial amount of money, This definitely could have an impact on those guys, as well as the likes of, there's some concerns over just in general religious groups, churches, and smaller. The people who give the smaller donations are the ones they're worrying about are going to be less likely to give.
We have about 2 minutes left, a little less than 2 minutes left. Are we actually seeing any nonprofits shutting down or on the verge of shutting down due to a lack of funds?
Well, the trend has been, I think, since the recession, Kevin, is merging. I've seen a lot of nonprofits in the Pittsburgh region say, hey, we have a similar mission. This is a way to cut overhead, and they combine. And that's
eliminate
been going.
Duplication of services.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. And Natasha, what have you seen in that?
Definitely there's been a trend in mergers and kind of creative ways. Maybe if it's not a traditional merger, figuring out ways to do things like find a shared CFO or, you know, figuring out other ways that they can complement each other instead of duplicating resources, as Joy said, as well. And just finding strength like in reducing things like overhead, administrative cost, those kinds of cost saving. Okay.
All right. In our remaining 45 seconds, what are each of you going to be following in the next weeks and months ahead regarding giving Pittsburgh, the tax reform impact, et cetera? Joyce, briefly.
I think how nonprofits are going to respond to the tax issue and, you know, look at how they're going to get their message out, who they're going to put their message out to, and what they're going to be doing internally to try to raise money.
And Natasha, what will you be looking for and to report on?
It will also be important to pay close attention to the actual figures that these emerge, because a lot of these things are estimates. You know, they are definitely afraid of the impact, but these are estimates, and so we need to see does this actually have as big of an impact as they're fearing or not, and to kind of as well as monitor at, take a closer look, I would like to, about the different ways that people are giving and how that's changing in today.
Very good. Natasha Lindstrom's a reporter for Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Joyce Gannon, a reporter for the Post-Gazette, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Pittsburgh companies show off their innovations this week at the largest consumer technology show in the world. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Now available, the new WESA mobile player for Android and iPhone. Stream us or listen to your favorite programs on demand, anywhere, anytime.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. 14 years after enacting Act 47, in which the state offers financial oversight to the city, Pittsburgh is close to exiting the program. The authority that monitors the city's finances voted this week to dissolve. And biology, not laziness, may be to blame for sleepy-eyed teens in class. Some schools are considering later start times, as puberty can affect how teens sleep and ultimately their performance in school. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For 50 years, the International Consumer Electronics Show has been held in Las Vegas, featuring inventions and gadgets and introducing next-generation innovations to the marketplace. Wraps up today, and just back in Pittsburgh from covering this year's event is Aaron Opperle, who reports on technology for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Great to be here, Kevin.
All right. I know you were working. I know you were reporting, and actually you'll have your final piece, I guess it is, published this weekend.
Yeah, something will be in the Tribune Review on Sunday, sort of looking at broad trends from the show.
All right, at triblive.com.
Yep.
Okay. But admit it, you had fun, didn't you?
4 days in Vegas. I mean, you can't beat that. I'll say I left Pittsburgh on Saturday when it was 0 degrees and landed in Las Vegas later that day, and it was 55, which felt like amazing 70. So that was nice. I mean, you can't have fun. You can't not have fun in Vegas. It's impossible.
You might have been the first person not to.
Yeah. I told my editor I did not gamble once, which shocked him. But, I mean, this is a party as well as a technology trade conference.
And big business for sure.
Oh, yes.
So have you been to this show before?
This was my first year.
So why? Was it because some Pittsburgh companies were showing off some of their innovations, or you just said, hey, I want to go?
Yeah, well, so we noticed last year for the first time that there was really a lot of Pittsburgh companies that were going there, making big announcements or trying to get their name out. And so we started planning this coverage last year, and then it happened to be great this year. There were several companies from the area that were either making an appearance or, you know, being out there for the first time, unveiling new technology, putting themselves on the market. And so to see a Pittsburgh company sort of operate in that global space and the way that they talk to their customers out there, or what how they highlight their products to an audience that is maybe familiar with them, that was really interesting. And just to network with them out there. I mean, sometimes it's hard to meet with some of these people in Pittsburgh, but out there they're accessible.
Yeah, and you can see also how they sort of perform among their competition or others.
Certainly, yes.
All right, so you mentioned Pittsburgh. What were they showing? What were their wares or innovations they were showing? One, there was a device developed to help people sleep?
Yeah, so Philips, which is this, you know, mega global company, they have their sleep and respironics center here in Pittsburgh. Right. They just built a new innovation center in Oakland. And one of the products that they developed largely there is called Smart Sleep. And it's a headband that you wear to bed. It's very soft, very flexible. The headband monitors electrical activity in your brain. And when it senses that you're falling into this really deep sleep called shortwave sleep, it sends a tone into your ear that amplifies those waves. And what they claim to do is that if you can only get 6 hours of sleep a night, by amplifying those waves, they'll give you the benefit of a full night's rest of 8 hours.
So it makes it a deeper sleep then?
A deeper sleep, a more restful sleep, a more restorative, and you get the benefit of the recovery without having to sleep longer. And, you know, their stats are 40% of Americans don't get enough sleep, and their hope is that by wearing this, you can still, you know, maybe get 5-6 hours, but feel like you got 8. Mm.
So we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, I guess, of exhibits and all that. So this particular one, how close are they? Because some are, you know, basically still in the idea stage or developmental stage, and others are ready to hit the market or what?
Yeah, so this one, the Smart Sleep, is ready to come out. They're going to hope to start selling it this spring. It's going to be over the counter. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't need a doctor's prescription or anything like that to buy it. And that's kind of the neat thing about CES is it is like a look into the future, because a lot of these products are being announced and will be available later this year or further on, like years out. A lot of times technologies get debuted there that don't really have a use yet. And it takes us several years to figure out, okay, well, here's what this is good for.
So somebody has the idea for the technology. Somebody else comes along and says, now here's how you can use it, apply it.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. So you mentioned, you wrote about Pittsburgh, another Pittsburgh company, Dynamics, was attracting interest. Interest in what?
So Dynamics is, they're out in Harmer, and they make credit cards, a credit card size device that you can store multiple cards on. So imagine having one card in your wallet, and on that card you could have your debit card, a credit card, your Giant Eagle Advantage card, your Port Authority card, and maybe a gift card that your mom got you for Christmas.
Okay.
All stored on one card. And all you have to do is just press a button on the card, and it changes in between those cards. What Dynamics announced out at CES this year was a card, same size as your credit card, that comes with a cell phone chip, cell phone antenna, and a battery that charges itself. This allows banks and other vendors to communicate directly with that card in real time. So if your card gets declined, it can tell you why. If there's been a security breach and your card is compromised, it can automatically rewrite your account data, send that to your card, and you go on uninterrupted without even having to get a new card in the mail. They can also send you messages, give you $5 off for your birthday, that sort of thing. So they see this as a huge advancement in card technology.
All right, Aaron. So I mentioned hundreds and hundreds of this. So you're walking through the show and all that. Tell us about one where you said, no way. It sort of knocked your socks off. And I'm not necessarily talking about your socks being embedded with sensors.
Yeah,
so
that,
what did you say?
That
wow,
was pretty
no
cool.
Way.
So there was one piece of technology that I still am a little like weirded out by, because it's just so next level and out there. It's a company called Signal, and they make a wristband that you wear.
All right.
And that wristband communicates with your smartphone. And if you've ever been in a really loud room and you get a phone call and you pick up your smartphone to listen to it, it's impossible to hear. What Signal does is, when you get a phone call, you can just put your finger up to your ear, kind of like you do when you're trying to hear better.
Yeah.
And it conducts the sound waves through your bones.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's crystal clear. It sounds like you're in a quiet room, like you've got noise-canceling headphones on. And it's wild. So that's one of those early-stage technologies that's not out yet, but It's pretty cool.
We have just a couple of minutes. Now, you say pretty cool. Now, conversely, was there one you said, you saw it, and you said, really? Really?
The smart shower.
Okay.
I don't see a need for a smart shower. So there were several of them out there. And major shower manufacturers and faucet manufacturers are making these. It's connected to your phone. There's an app. It can communicate with Alexa or the Google Assistant. It has artificial intelligence that will remember your temperature preferences. They come with speakers. And I guess to me, that's just never been a problem that I need solved in my life. But they're out there, and they'll be on the market, and I guarantee you people will buy them.
All right. I believe you wrote about, I don't know, a sea of robots, and that wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, yeah.
Give me a robot. There was a, what is it? Laundroid?
The Laundroid. So this is a robot that's trying to solve a problem that I think we all have. No one likes to fold laundry. And this robot, it's about the size of a refrigerator. It weighs about as much as a piano.
Oh, my.
Cost $16,000, but it will fold your laundry for you. It'll take a long time. It takes about 15 minutes to fold one shirt. So you just dump your laundry into the Laundroid before you take off for work. And when you get home, it's all stacked up nicely. And I liked Laundroid because it was trying to solve a problem that I think people really do have. And that if we could not fold laundry, think of all the time we would have to do other things. The technology's not there yet, but it's a good start.
All right. Does it fold laundry better than you do?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. So just a quick minute left. And so after seeing all this, whether it's a robot or any of these other things that you have mentioned or haven't mentioned, Aaron, what's the one item that's on your wish list for next Christmas?
Oh, boy. It's a wine rack.
It's okay.
This wine rack remembers where you put the bottles in the wine rack. It inventories your wine for you. And then when you're cooking dinner, if you tell it what you're cooking dinner, it will suggest a wine in your inventory to pair with that dinner. I would love that. So if anyone out there is listening, that's what I want.
All right. Aaron Opperle is a technology reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks, Aaron. We look forward to your last story at triblive.com.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, Governor Wolf declares a state emergency to deal with the opioid crisis. Would really help those battling this health epidemic? That's next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first NHL Winter Classic is played in Orchard Park, New York in 2008, with the Pittsburgh Penguins defeating the Buffalo Sabres 2-1. It was the first outdoor regular season professional hockey game played in the U.S. More than 71,000 people attended, and the outdoor games have become an annual NHL tradition. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for January 5th, 2018.
WESA is supported by Yahoo Small Business, offering tools designed to start and grow a business. Resources available include everything from creating a website and selling online to advertising and marketing. More information is available at smallbusiness.yahoo.com/NPR.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin.
Those that we have lost are not just numbers. They're mothers, their fathers, sons, daughters, family members, neighbors, all of them contributing members of our society.
That's Governor Tom Wolf Wednesday declaring opioids' effect on Pennsylvania a disaster emergency. The Commonwealth becomes the eighth state to make such a declaration. We're going to discuss what this latest effort to ease the opioid crisis might actually mean with Rich Lord, investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Rich.
Hey, Kevin.
And joining us from the Post-Gazette State Capitol Bureau in Harrisburg is reporter Liz Navratil. Hi, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And your comments and questions are encouraged. Tweet us, use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, before we get to what this declaration means, let's get an assessment from you both about just how bad the opioid crisis is in Pennsylvania? Are we seeing any progress or anything? Let's start with you, Liz, then to Rich.
Sure. Right now, it's very hard to get a definite picture because a lot of the drug tests that are being done on cases from last year are still coming in. The state officials have said that based off of some preliminary data provided by the CDC or a projection by the CDC, that they do expect to have seen an increase again last year. So it certainly doesn't seem to be a problem that is subsiding anytime soon.
Yeah, overdoses have just, fatal overdoses have just continued to mount year after year for the last 5 years or so, to the point where they think that the 2016 number was about 5,000 and the 2017 number is going to be a lot higher. In Allegheny County, there were 650 fatal overdoses in 2016, and they're talking about hundreds more for 2017. There's just nothing that's really turned the tide on this since fentanyl came on the scene.
And all those numbers have made Pennsylvania, I believe, the fourth highest rate of addiction-related deaths in the country. So and those numbers, as you allude to, seem to be going up for 17. So in the past, Pennsylvania has suffered flooding, blizzards, devastating winds. We're used to hearing the emergency declaration when it comes to natural disasters. So why is it being used by state governments to address really a public health issue?
It looks like the governor saw this as a way to cut through more than a dozen essentially pieces of red tape that stood between saving lives and getting people into treatment. It was a quick temporary measure, 90 days. You're right, it was very novel. This hasn't been done for a public health emergency before.
Liz?
Yes. I know a lot of people are hearing that 90-day number and wondering why 90 days and can you do anything in 90 days, which are very fair questions. The short answer to that is that 90 days is the cutoff for this type of declaration as outlined in the state constitution. So Governor Wolf and his administration have said that they really hope these next 3 months will allow them to see what would happen if certain regulations were to be lifted on a more permanent basis. And if things were to go well, they would look at changing things permanently or possibly extending this again in the future.
We know
there had been some thoughts about doing this in the past, but it had never come to fruition.
Right. Do we know if he can just make another declaration or does he have to ask for one? You mentioned the constitutional aspect to the 90-day limit.
Yes, he can do another declaration if he would like to. My understanding is that this technically gets approved by a council of some sort, but they did not anticipate any resistance. I think this is an issue that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle in Harrisburg are chiming in on,
all right,
especially as election season is ramping up in various races.
Okay. Now, let's talk about what this designation actually does do for these 90 days. Rich, what does it do? Does it eliminate some red tape? What?
Yeah, it kind of lifts some regulatory barriers that it kept first responders and treatment providers from doing their job as well as they hope to. For instance, medics show up at a non-fatal overdose and save somebody using naloxone.
All right.
And they can't leave it behind currently, at least prior to this declaration. They can't leave a dose of naloxone behind so that the next time this person overdoses, a friend or family member could save them. One of the most tangible results of the declaration is that now they can leave a dose behind. So hopefully that person gets that life-saving drug very promptly if they go down that road again.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing it does is centralize kind of command for this. You've got different state agencies, counties, cities, researchers at all the universities, hospitals, et cetera, all working on this issue and all not knowing how to communicate with each other. This creates kind of an opioid command center that's supposed to bring everything together.
Liz, what stands out to you what this declaration might mean?
I think Rich did a good job of hitting some of the high points there. In addition, we know this also changes the list of conditions that need to be reported to the state. So we will now get more information on overdoses in which people survive and also children who are born in withdrawal. And part of the reason that has excited some people is because a lot of the data that exists right now really focuses on cases that have ended in death. There has also been some talk about whether this might allow, say, the health department or the department's coordinating drug and alcohol programs to coordinate with, say, the state police or the Department of Corrections to try and speed up the process at which they can get certain people into treatment. Whether it will do those things, only time will tell, but that's certainly the goal as it has been outlined.
All right. Let's hear now from Denise Shanahan. She is raising her grandchildren after losing her daughter, Brianna, to a drug overdose. She's uncertain what impact this emergency declaration will have. She wants to see more efforts at keeping prescription drugs away from teenagers in the first place, and therefore prevent them or discourage them from making that first bad decision.
I think there's also the thing to try to catch this before, you know, the kids, delve into this. Again, I keep saying to people, why is this happening? You know, we need to figure out the underlying reason. I'm trying to figure out why.
All right. Liz and Rich, in your reporting, have you found any efforts that address the sort of the earliest days of sort of building toward addiction, education efforts, ways to talk to kids and young adults long before they come into contact with painkillers? We'll start with you, Rich.
Sure. First of all, in 2016, the state passed a law that puts extra hurdles in between physicians and providing narcotics prescriptions to young people. So they've done something in that regard. And schools are starting to come around to this idea of prevention. We're starting to see schools take a number of measures to kind of get good evidence-based anti-drug messages in front of their student bodies, not kind of the old model of here's your brain on drugs, but here's how you can make good decisions, good healthy decisions. Here are ways you might deal with peer pressure if you run into these drugs, you know, either in your high school years or further on. But it's really just beginning, and it's all scattershot. Some districts are doing a lot. Other districts have barely touched this.
Liz, have you noticed any efforts to sort of head off the problem before it really grabs a hold of young people?
I have not heard of that in particular relation to this declaration. There has been some talks about different things they could do to try and speed up the process by which people could get treatment after their addiction has been identified. For example, they've talked about waiving a regulation that requires a doctor to be the one to start the admission process if someone is seeking treatment, whereas they might waive that regulation and allow a nurse or a nurse practitioner to be the first person to get that ball rolling. But in terms of additional efforts in the schools and those kinds of things, it's certainly possible they're happening, but I in particular am not aware.
Okay. You mentioned treatment, and I want to move there now. Lucy Garrigan is the CEO of a Pittsburgh area treatment facility, Jade Wellness Center. She told WESA that she hopes the declaration will prioritize mandated treatment after an overdose.
Just buying Narcan, naloxone, doesn't help unless we treat people after their incident. If somebody continues to overdose, we need to say, you need to go to treatment and get help, instead of continually providing more and more and more naloxone.
All right. Rich, you alluded to earlier about leaving naloxone doses behind just in case there is another overdose by an individual. But let's talk about that, the idea of mandated treatment. I know there's some legislation that would do that. How important is it, and are you stepping on somebody's rights?
Sure. There's a bill by State Senator Jay Costa, and I think Jim Brewster, another state senator, has a similar bill that would allow a family member to say, okay, my family member has a drug problem. It's threatening either their safety or the safety of those around them. We need to bring them before a hearing officer and get them committed, kind of like a mental health commitment, to treatment for a period of time. The bill, as it's being amended, does not lock the person up in a treatment center. It just essentially orders them to go there. They won't be held in contempt of court if they don't go there. So it kind of avoids really tramping hard on civil liberties by being kind of a little bit wishy-washy in its effects. But the question is whether somebody who hasn't decided in and of themselves that this is the time they're going to get clean, if forcing them or compelling them to go into treatment is really going to be a good use of resources.
Yeah, you mentioned the Costa bill, and then you also Brewster. And so that's the Costa bill has to do with family members and trying to get people, get the loved ones who are no longer minors into treatment. But I believe Brewster's legislation also would allow others to sort of take, and whether it's police. I know some police officials, Liz, have said that they're frustrated. They can give out naloxone, but maybe they'd like to drop somebody off at a treatment center.
I mean, that's certainly something that I heard from people off and on when I was working on a crime beat. I know the administration up here has been very adamant that they don't want to use naloxone as like a silver bullet sort of idea, that they want to still try to get people into treatment and sort of use the naloxone leave behind as a last resort kind of effort. In terms of the Brewster bill in particular and whether that's going anywhere, it's hard to tell because these guys have been gone for a couple of weeks now and don't come back until January 22nd.
Okay. Rich, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, there appear to be methods that work. If someone really wants to get treatment and shows up at an emergency room after an overdose and is put into a detox and then is put promptly into a rehabilitation program, and then gets follow-up after they leave the rehabilitation program, maybe with medication, maybe without, but gets follow-up. Kind of like you treat cancer. You get cancer into remission, but then you don't just ignore it. You know, you continue to keep on it. That's the model some of the more, I guess, thoughtful and enlightened, I think, experts are looking at for addiction right now.
Now, so even if there is mandatory treatment, say these bills get passed, are there enough facilities? Is there any money to pay for the treatment, though?
No. There's not enough facilities, either inpatient or outpatient, to treat everybody. If you started putting everybody who gets busted for possession or whose family members are concerned about them into this into the treatment system, if you try to do that, you're going to get horrendous waiting lists. And you might prevent, therefore, somebody who really is ready for treatment from getting in there.
Liz, my understanding is that this emergency declaration by the governor, it doesn't include any funding for any particular programs, does it?
It is not any extra money that is not already in the budget. What we've been hearing from folks at the state level is that, truthfully, there's not a lot of extra money floating around. If you have been following state politics, you know we had a month-long budget impasse. The early indications are that there likely won't be any additional funding as a result of the declaration mentioned in the upcoming budget address, which is in a couple of weeks, looking forward to next year. Whether they try and do any additional funding that isn't tied to the declaration, we'll have to kind of keep an eye out and see.
We have less than a minute left, so very, very briefly, is there anything that to be optimistic about, something that is working to start at least, you know, take a little bit out of this epidemic?
Yeah, there are things that work. There are proven prevention programs that take down the percentage of people who choose drugs by meaningful percentage points. There are, as I said, kind of beginning to end treatment models that can get people to a point, if they want to get to that point, at which they're less likely to relapse. There are people that are getting better. We're going to be writing about some of them next week also. So the city of Pittsburgh is doing what's called a post-overdose response team. Coming up in a couple months, they're going to send people out when somebody has overdosed and help to do whatever they can to get that person into treatment. So, yeah, there are some glimmers of hope out there.
Rich Lord and Liz Navratil are reporters for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for our program is Tom Hurley. Research assistance from Zakiya Madyun. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.